I remember back when Dr. Colm Kelleher and I were working on the book that became Hunt for the Skinwalker. This is the mid-2000s, 7, 8 years ago. One of the stories that we collected was based on the accounts given by two Native American police officers, credible guys, who told about being out on patrol one night in the Uinta Basin, driving around a bend, and they saw these two guys standing in the darkness. They thought they were two guys standing in the darkness wearing trench coats, smoking cigarettes. And they thought it was odd that they were out there in the middle of nowhere, so they shined a light on them, and the guys turned around, presumably were guys, and they were standing on two legs like men, wearing a trench coat like men, but their faces were dogs, not masks. And these two police officers kind of looked at each other and then glanced back, and these things were gone, just as if they vanished. They got out of their cars, went over to the spot where they'd been standing, wondering if they had imagined the whole thing, and saw the cigarette butts still burning there on the ground. So they're pretty sure that what they saw was real. They just couldn't explain it. And as we're putting together the book, it was the only story that we heard out of a sea of weirdness that we really considered not including, because it is so preposterous on its face, so ridiculous, that we feared that it would cause people to wonder if we just made this stuff up, if the rest of the stuff was equally suspicious. And but we ended up deciding, well, what the heck, we're not going to be censoring ourselves. We're going to put it in and let it let the chips fall where they may. And at the time, we had heard no other stories, had no credible stories about dog men, men with dog faces. But since then, we've encountered quite a few of them from all over the country, in particular in the works and the writings of Linda Godfrey, who's my guest tonight. She wrote a couple of books that I think are familiar to our listeners. The Michigan Dogman, Werewolves and Other Canines, The Beast of Bray Road, among others. I think Linda has been a guest with George Norrie to talk about those. And now her latest book is called Real Wolfmen, True Encounters in Modern America, and sort of draws out not only the research she's done in those earlier works, but new cases that have come her way, including some, as I mentioned, from Coast to Coast listeners. When we come back, we jump right into the thick of it with Linda Godfrey. Don't go away. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Linda Godfrey is one of the most respected authorities on anomalous animals and paranormal phenomena in Wisconsin. She's a journalist. She broke the story of the Bray Road Beast and has continued to pursue her interests into these unknown phenomena, has gone on to investigate an array of unusual animals allegedly lurking in her home state and around the country. And her new book, as I mentioned, Real Wolfmen, True Encounters in Modern America, is a good read. It's a fun read. A lot of really scary, chilling stories. Linda, so glad to have you on the program.
For having me. I'm just tickled to be here.
I don't know if you were able to listen to our callers in that last hour.
I wasn't. I was having some trouble with my laptop. But I did hear that you received a few good tales.
And we're going to pass them along to you. What strikes me from that, we hear these stories from these callers, and several more folks were holding on the phone trying to get through. We hope they'll call in later, because I think they had some pretty good stories too. And I'm not a psychic. I don't have a built-in lie detector. However, I do have a gut that is not
right.
Foolproof, but pretty good. And what strikes me is these people are telling the truth. They were relating something that really did happen to them. They weren't making it up. They're not looking for attention. They're a little bit worried about being made fun of.
Right.
And I get the feeling from your book that that's a lot of what you run into.
Pretty much the majority, I would say. Most people who contact me are just wanting to tell somebody who won't think they're crazy. They're not seeking anything. Once in a while, there's a jokester in there, but they're usually able to be weeded out.
Why don't we back up for those who haven't heard your earlier interviews on this program? Give me a thumbnail sketch of how you got hooked on this story.
Well, it was back in the late 1991, early 1992, and I was working as a newspaper reporter when I learned that people around my own hometown of Elkhorn, Wisconsin, were saying they were seeing a werewolf out on this stretch of lonely highway right outside of town called Bray Road. And when I started checking around, I found out that there indeed were a number of people saying this. And not only that, they were phoning in their reports to our county animal control officer. That got my attention, because In my experience, people who are trying to hoax something don't first report to the authorities, you know, because they don't want to be investigated. And then I learned that this official, when I went to visit him, had in his possession a manila file folder that he had labeled werewolf, for lack of a better word, because people were calling him and saying, I saw this thing. I don't know what it was. It was on its hind legs, looked like a dog or a wolf, 5 or 7 feet tall, covered with shaggy fur. If there was such a thing as a werewolf, this would be it. So that right away made it a news story. And I wrote it up. I interviewed the witnesses, and I was very skeptical. But to my surprise, I believed them. You know, they ran the gamut from old, young, men, women, farmers, blue-collar, professional, you name it, they were in the mix. And none of them seemed like they were, you know, joking, or many of them still seemed terrified, even when they'd had sightings several years earlier, you know, and I started to think there was something to it. And once it got out, it went national in about 2 weeks and sort of made me the de facto werewolf go-to person, both for the public and for media, because really nobody else was attempting to collect contemporary reports of something that sounded like a werewolf. You know, it just was not on the radar screen for most people. And after about 10 years, I still had so much interest from everybody and had gathered so many reports that I felt they ought to be put together into a book to be preserved, if nothing else. And that started the book career.
Tell me about what it was like in the newsroom. It sounded like it starts off as sort of a feature story. Hey, Linda, go have some fun with this.
Exactly.
And then it becomes something else. And I just wanted to know what the reaction was when you start taking this seriously, what your editors thought, what your colleagues thought.
Well, you know, there were snickers and people disbelieving and jokes. Mostly, you know, and I think that attitude still persists a lot today in that your classic newsroom, because it's not something that most people want to consider as having even a remote possibility of being real, because it just shakes their worldview too much. So, you know, there was always that little joking attitude, and they weren't always that thrilled when I would want to do an update. I think I maybe did a total of 5 over 10 years that I worked for that newspaper. So, you know, it's just something that you learn to work with, and it never really bothered me.
Did there come a time when they said no, no more?
No, not really. I just really felt the need to leave the newspaper to do something really bigger with it.
I have had similar experiences in chasing the UFO story over the years. It seems like the people it bothers most are fellow journalists. They just
exactly.
Can't stand that you're chasing this. Like somehow it hurts their credibility that anyone would take it seriously. But I always resented the fact that they dismiss this out of hand and figure it's ridiculous, and none of them have done any work on it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you've investigated it thoroughly and then formed an opinion, well, that's one thing. But when you're just having a knee-jerk reaction that, oh, well, this is a silly thing, I therefore can't believe in it, you know, I don't respect that sort of opinion then.
Tell me about the number of reports that had come into that animal control guy at that time, and how many you've added to the file since.
Well, I think he had 5 or 6, if I recall, and I had a couple of others. A few others came to light, and as soon as the story appeared, the other stories began rolling in, just on radio shows, even just little local talk shows, people would call in and tell theirs. And I've had reports, I mean, this is 20 years later, and I think I got 4 or 5 this week, you know, just out of the blue. It varies. Usually every week I'll get between 1 and 3 on an average. So you're talking hundreds of reports. They're not all of equal quality. You know, some are much more detailed, and the writer seems much more credible. There are others that you just kind of chuckle and write, thank you for sharing, and that's it. You know, so they're not all reports are created equal, but I don't have an exact tally, but
okay.
It's in the hundreds.
Well, hundreds, though.
Yeah.
I won't dwell on this media topic. Just one more question, then we'll move on. But I'm just wondering whether other media rivals in other publications took you on and made fun of it.
You know, actually, I would say people have been pretty kind. And I think maybe part of that is because I have tried, not that there aren't little jokes and things like that, don't get me wrong, but I've really tried and still do try to keep my reporter hat on. I play my own devil's advocate. I try to provide alternate explanations. I look for other, you know, rationales when I can. And so I think it kind of brings people along and they can see that I'm not just chasing some fairy tale. I'm trying to apply some thought and some sort of methodology to it.
Give me the central characteristics, sort of a thumbnail sketch of the Bray Road creature, the kinds of common characteristics reported by the witnesses you talked to.
Well, the amazing thing is that they were fairly similar, and they've remained very persistently similar over the years and over the whole country. And generally, people describe a creature that stands on its hind legs, walks and runs on its hind legs, although it can alternate between that and all fours when it wants to, 5 to 7 feet tall, covered with usually darker, shaggy fur, although that can vary to shorter or to gray, much as you would find in a natural wolf pack, variations in fur. They will normally describe a long snout, fangs, pointed ears on top of the head, and they'll say things like, it walked or ran really easily, but its legs were bent backwards. And by that, they're meaning, without really thinking about it, that the canines run and walk on their toe pads versus apes and even bears that will run flat-footed. And they'll say it ran easily, but it also was sort of hunched over. And again, they're just describing without thinking the canine anatomy and the way that the head and neck are attached to the spine. It's not really meant to be perfectly erect like a human when we walk. So they're pretty much persistent. And the weird thing is that so many people, I get the same words over and over. They'll say, well, you know, as it looked at me, I felt that it was, they'll say either jeering or leering or sneering, one of those three words, because they feel that it has this attitude, kind of a superior, I'm here, you're there, you can't get me, that kind of thing. And they find that extremely unsettling in a wild animal. And between that and the fact that, you know, it's on its hind legs and sometimes even holding dead animals in its paws, you know, it's the behavior really even more than the appearance that scares people.
I guess it's a good thing it's holding dead animals in its paws and not dead humans, but you
exactly.
Had reported in the book, in this book, Real Wolfman, that in some of those instances it charged at them. It looked like it was going after them, but never actually got anybody.
Right. It seems to, you know, do feints or fake attacks. Its main objective normally appears to be to scare the person, to kind of get them off their guard, and then be able to escape into whatever cover is nearby. And there's almost always cover. It's not something that is usually out in the open. There's, you know, shrubbery or a cornfield or a woods or something, even a ditch, that it can jump into and get away. Although occasionally people will say that it did not seem all that concerned and just strolled off on its hind legs too, and I'd attribute that to, you know, personalities between different animals.
As far as you know, other than some claw marks on a car, it hasn't hurt anybody.
I have one case of one gentleman from the Quebec province who was attacked on a trail when he ran right into one, was unarmed. It lunged at him, and he said he sort of jumped the wrong way in his panic, and he thinks it was sort of his fault. He does not think the animal intended to hurt him because he said it could have just gutted him, you know, as close and large as it was, if it had wanted to. But it grazed his side and hip with one of its fangs as it brushed past him, and left kind of a tear in the skin. He sent me a picture of the scar, and he had to go to a hospital and get it sewn up, and he told them it was a bear because he didn't want to say what it really was. But, you know, a bear probably would have done a lot more damage than that.
Describe for me the nature of physical evidence left at these scenes. Are there tracks? Do people go back out and look for footprints or hoof prints or whatever they are?
Yeah, tracks are probably the best because they don't really look exactly like you would expect a normal dog or wolf print to be. They tend to be around 6 inches in diameter. Sometimes we have some that show an extra mark that's sort of like a heel mark, which I think is actually the part of the canine leg that we would call the heel and ankle joint, touching the ground when it's pouncing at something or running in a certain way. But I've even just as recently as last May measured 6.5-inch wolf prints in southeastern Wisconsin. And really, that is not an average wolf size. They're usually much smaller than that for a timber wolf. And there did not appear to be any forelimb prints.
So, are there wolves in the areas that you're describing where these things happen? Are there natural wolves?
In some areas, yes. In most areas, there's not any big population to speak of. They are repopulating in Wisconsin, but mostly in the northern half. In the southern half of the state is really the man-wolf hot area and has many, many fewer wolves. They're here, but they're very, very rare.
You ever have people go out there and try to track them? I would think if they leave tracks that some guy who's a hunter would want to go after one.
Right. And the trouble is a lot of the times the terrain just isn't right. When you can see them, it's pretty fun. I've been able to see a couple of them where you could tell they were going after deer. In one, which was actually within just south of Milwaukee, in the South Milwaukee area, there was a mud puddle, and you could see this drama that had occurred. There were deer prints, and you could see that these huge canine prints that measured 8 inches in length, including that extra little mark that I was mentioning, were pouncing at the deer, and you could see where the deer's hind hoofs had dug into the mud as it tried to get itself out. There wasn't any sign that anything had been killed there, so I'm assuming the deer got away. But the recent ones in May, I also was able to see where the wolf prints came out of the brush, followed a deer across a cornfield, scuffled with the deer, and then the deer ran off toward the woods, and the man-wolf or whatever it is, went his just disappeared because the ground got very dry and crusty, and the deer hoofs could penetrate, but his couldn't. So you can read these little dramas sometimes. But I have had a tracker actually track prints from the Holy Hill bear wolf incident. He tracked them for quite a ways until they disappeared into a swamp. And then wasn't able to follow them anymore.
What's the attitude of police? I mean, the reports must go to police as well as to animal control. I just wonder if they take it seriously and get out and investigate.
In my experience, they normally tend to poo-poo it, and I don't know if they have their own reasons for that or what, but time and time again, when people have reported it to the police, all they'll be able to get out is, standing up, furry, and then immediately the policeman will write down Yeti or Bigfoot or start joking around about Bigfoot because they don't really understand that there are such things as dogman sightings, or if they do, they really don't want to admit it. So the great majority of people who report find it scoffed at.
Linda Godfrey, we've just begun our conversation about your new book, Real Wolf Men, True Encounters in Modern America. Much more to come, including the paranormal aspects, because some of this stuff, it starts off weird, but it gets weirder. So stay with us, everyone, for more Coast to Coast AM. Linda Godfrey, so much of what we think we know about werewolves, wolf men, dog men comes from Hollywood. Of course, they sort of set out the rules. You need a silver bullet to kill them. They transform from men into wolves under the influence of a full moon. And as you note in your book, a lot of this is just completely made up. But some of what Hollywood has done does get it right. And I want to know, just sort of lead into bringing it up to date in some of your current stories, if you could talk about the big picture of how long these stories have been around. Certainly a lot longer than Hollywood's been around, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can go back to some of the most ancient cave paintings and pictographs, both in Europe and in the Americas, and you can find diagrams of what appear to be humans merging with wolves, other animals. It's a really ancient idea, and it's often hard for us to interpret, you know, looking back many millennia sometimes and trying to figure out what they mean, but, you know, sometimes I think maybe they are just trying to get across the idea that there are creatures that look like animals but walk like men.
Talk about the Greeks and Romans. They had stories.
Yeah, the Greeks and Romans had were just sort of steeped in Wolfman lore, and they had a holiday called Lupercalia that was considered sort of orgiastic, but it was, again, Luper for the lupine, wolf refers to the wolf. Rome was supposed to have been founded by Romulus and Remus that were twins suckled by a wolf, you know. So we seem to have this deep connection to wolves and dogs and other canines, and that's proven by the long association of humans with dogs. You know, they keep pushing the time that humans and domesticated wolves back farther and farther. So, you know, I think there's sort of a psychological connection that predisposes us to see human traits in wolves, especially when they're standing upright and walking around and holding things with their forepaws. You know, we tend to anthropomorphize it and just almost want to see this human trait in them. I, however, do not think that these things are human at all, except in some rare cases where perhaps you have so-called magical things going on, or specific mental practices that can make manifestations that look like the same creatures. But I think that what most people are seeing is something that is really hard to understand. Perhaps a real animal that has adapted, but not at all what Hollywood would have us believe.
Well, we'll definitely jump into that. I just want to stick for another minute or two with how long these stories have been around. You know, you see the drawings in Egyptian temples and things of that sort, head of a jackal. It's costumes in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah, a lot of those, the one that most people think of, and I do hear many people make comparisons to Anubis, which was the Egyptian god of the dead, guide to the underworld, and had many duties in the underworld. And Anubis is actually the jackal with, usually depicted with the very tall ears. That's what they remark upon often, is the ears and the long snout. But when you do see the illustrations, oftentimes people don't realize they're really depicting a priest wearing an Anubis headpiece and mask that covers his whole head, because that's how the priests would enact some of these same rites. However, it's hard to tell where to draw the line with that, because other ones do appear to be, you know, the animal standing upright. So you actually have both kinds there.
How far back does the idea go that humans can turn into these other creatures, that we can, by wearing a bear skin, adapt some of the powers of a bear, or same thing with a wolf?
Well, we know it goes back to the Vikings for sure, because they had this tradition called berserkers, which means bear shirt, where warriors would put on the pelt of either a bear or a wolf, and then when they charged into battle, they would take on the characteristics of that animal. And some people really believe that they truly turned into the animal, that they sort of transformed into them. You know, so that's many millennia. And then, again, the cave paintings are always subject to interpretation, but some of the very oldest ones, even going back to some of the ancient sightings in old Anatolia, which is now Turkey, you see man-like bodies with heads of birds or other animals. And in all cases, they're probably doing that because they want to take on the characteristics of the animal. So, you know, it's hard to say how they were doing that. We don't know these days. But But at least the idea of the tradition goes back many, many millennia.
It seems like it's everywhere, too. I mean, I recall reading stories from India, from China, way back,
right,
of not necessarily just wolves, but people adapting the characteristics of other kinds of animals or were animals of different sorts.
Right.
It's almost universal.
It is. It's very universal. There are certain Chinese people who believe that they're descended from dogs, and it's a big source of pride. They have annual dog festivals. They have certain ladies' hairdos that are supposed to look like dog ears, you know. So, and you go to Africa and you find the Dogon, and just every continent there's this affinity with wolves and dogs.
Tell us about one of the things I found interesting in your new book is how much of the werewolf legend, the wolfman legend, is just made up by Hollywood. Some of the key parts of the story that we might accept as fact is just nonsense.
Well, right. Yeah, a lot of people think that that little verse that they recite in the Wolfman, even a man who is righteous at heart or recites his prayers by night and about the wolf's bane and that sort of thing, a lot of people think that's an actual ancient Romanian saying, but it was just made up by the screenwriter. And things like turning into a werewolf from being bitten by another one, that was largely a Hollywood invention. There's some basis in the silver bullet in that there's kind of a long-standing tradition that silver hurts all fey creatures. And then going back to the Beast of Gévaudan in France, which was several centuries ago, there supposedly is a tradition that that beast was finally killed when they melted down a silver chalice from the local church, and because that was a holy object, then the silver bullets were able to kill the creatures. But it's not really known how true that is either. You know, it might actually be partly made up. So the waters get a little murky there. But so much of the Hollywood tradition, the idea of the full moon making people turn into werewolves, and then you have this idea of the figure contorting and the hair sprouting out and everything. You know, that was all done for Hollywood effect.
Well, I have trouble with envisioning the physical process, the
right,
change from man into wolf, how scientifically that could be possible. You know, and we've seen
right,
it a million times in movies. That has to give a skeptic pause for concern.
Right, and I've always said I really don't believe that physical humans physically change into physical wolves, you know, because you have to start thinking that all of the cellular changes that would have to take place, right down to the DNA governs the traits, and so is the DNA going to change? You know, when you really start thinking about it, the idea just sort of falls apart. I have not ruled out the possibility, however, that there are certain rigorous mental practices and perhaps even magical rites that enable people to manifest the appearance of one of these creatures, sort of like a spirit suit, if you will, is maybe a good way of putting it. Sort of a mental projection might be another way of thinking it, projecting a thought so that it is able to appear. And that even sounds very airy-fairy, but there's a lot more anecdotal evidence, I think, for that sort of thing being possible. And I go into that in a lot more detail in the books, of course. It's kind of a complex subject.
Well, psychologically, it makes sense that you can talk yourself into believing that you adopt the powers of wolf. If I put this wolf coat on, I'm going to run a lot faster. I guess you could psych yourself into that.
Yeah, there's that, and then, you know, some people believe that we have an almost sometimes visible spirit body. Some people would call it the aura or the second body, the astral double, and that is, in certain highly trained people, they're able to make that visible to other people and form other shapes. And I've found some Native American resources that indicate that that's sort of what goes on with what you call the skinwalker or the skin changer. So, you know.
Well, we definitely want to get into that.
Oh, yes, that's right up your alley.
Yes.
People so often ask me if I've ever read your book, and of course, I've mentioned it in several of my books, and I have a copy of it, and it's pretty interesting.
Tell me about it. Let's spend a couple of minutes leading up to the hour, and we'll get into the Skinwalker stuff in the next hour, but talking about some of the cases that you mentioned in this new book. The Ghadara thing is a real tingler.
Yeah, and that actually, you know, I've uncovered a lot more about that. That appears in some of my earlier books. It involves a 1936 incident where the night watchman at a facility for developmentally challenged people, mostly children, was on his rounds and was coming around to an old Native American burial mound and saw a creature digging in it. The creature looked up and then stood up on its hind legs and was a 7-foot-tall thing that had very canine features. And it looked, they had a sort of a stare down and it ran away. The second night, it was there again, and this time it uttered what he called a proto-human voice, and it was sort of a growl, and the word he thought that it said was Gadara. And in the Bible, Gadara is the region where Jesus was able to cast demons out of either one or two madmen, depending on which chapter you're reading at the time. And then the demons went into a herd of swine, which cast themselves into the sea. So there's that kind of amazing coincidence there. And I've in recent times, I've found out that even before that, there were exorcisms going on in the area and just really heavy-duty, strange activity. So you just wonder if there are certain areas that are prone to that.
Well, you make the point that there are areas that have names that would sort of lend themselves to, you think, somewhere back, way back when, weird stuff happened here.
Right.
And David Politis, a friend of mine who's been on the program, he mentions that as well. Some of the research he's done, that Devil's Peak and things of that sort seem to, weird stuff pops up again and again in those kinds of areas.
It does, yeah. And Wisconsin has a very famous Devil's Lake, which is supposed to be haunted and sits in a very unusual geological formation. And the thing is, generally, when you find these names like Devil's Elbow, Devil's Lake, they were pretty much misnamed by the settlers. Normally, if you look back far enough, they'll mean something like Spirit Lake or Spirit's Elbow. And, of course, this was all considered heathen Indian religion, and so they would call it Devil, you know, instead of Spirit.
Now back to this Ghadara story. I mean, that's pretty spooky stuff. When you realize that word that this being uttered or growled relates back to an experience that Jesus had with some demons that he cast out, suggesting
right.
All kinds of possibilities.
Right. It really is. And, of course, I always, again, play my own devil's advocate. And I have to say the G and the R sounds are kind of what you hear when most animals like that would growl. And so it's hard to say whether it truly was a word or whether it just sounded like that. This man was a very religious, practicing Catholic and had probably heard that word, you know. So you always have to add the little grain of salt that says maybe he had heard it and interpreted it that way. But it certainly, in the context of this unusual creature that he was observing and having this interaction with, you know, you have to take that into consideration as well. And his interpretation of the creature was that it was a demon straight from hell. Those were his words.
This guy didn't want to tell this story either.
No, and he never did until he thought he was dying. He actually lived a few years longer, but when he thought he was dying, he told his son, Joe, who is a man of just impeccable ethics, who was a newspaper editor, and who had never told anybody else until he heard about the Beast of Bray Road when the news broke back in very early 1992, and he saw it on TV, and then he contacted me and said, well, you'll never guess what my dad saw.
And again, it sort of goes into what we were saying about witnesses who come forward. They're reluctant. They're not trying to cash in. They're not trying to become famous. They really don't want to tell anybody, even their own family.
Right, exactly. Many times it's fear of ridicule. Sometimes it's just denial. Sometimes they feel that they might burden their family or scare them if they tell them about it. People have a lot of reasons, but so many people will say, you know, I saw this thing 5 years ago, and I just have never been able to bring myself to tell anyone about it, you know, either for any of those reasons. So it was very much like that, especially in those times when there were just things that were not easily spoken of. People weren't used to talking about the paranormal the way that we do today, and some subjects were just taboo.
Give me sort of a laundry list. We got to take a break in a couple of minutes, but laundry list of the common characteristics in the cases that you've noticed. I know you have a short list of the things that sort of tie them together.
I'm not sure exactly.
Well, like bodies of water or...
Oh, sure. That's a really big characteristic is there's almost always water right nearby, and even if it's just a tiny creek, it will lead to a watershed that leads to a bigger area of water. I've also noticed, even in the incidents where these creatures don't appear to do anything supernatural, they're just, you know, oddly walking on their hind legs and carrying dead deer parts around in their forepaws, they tend to recur again and again in places like cemeteries, churchyards, crossroads, highways, and military installations. And these happen to be, and I didn't realize this for many years until I had built up my database, you know, and going back and looking where each of these things occurred. And I realized that these correlate exactly with the sites where black phantom hounds and other creatures like that are found in the British Isles and Europe.
Crossroads, you have some interesting material in the book about that, why it would make sense that they would show up there.
Well, there are lots of old European traditions about crossroads that, you know, the devil appears there and can be defeated. There's an old tradition that werewolves show up at the crossroads and you can stymie them by dropping a bushel of wheat or something because they have to compulsively count every kernel and you can run away. But there are lots of different ideas about it. One is that it makes the sign of the cross. So if you have somebody who was a witch or considered evil, you bury them there, and then they can't come back and get you. The devil appears at the crossroads because it kind of symbolizes the meeting of the spirit world and the earth world where they intersect, as well as two roads intersecting. So you have all kinds of occult significance at these crossroads. And the interesting thing, George, is that as crossroads are disappearing because we have these interstates coming in everywhere, we're building more and more interstates, and you can't have a road going directly across an interstate. We have these cloverleaf on and off ramps. I'm getting more and more reports from creatures seen at the on and off ramps.
Oh, my gosh. And next thing you know, you see one drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's. We continue our conversation with Linda Godfrey, author of the new book, Real Wolfmen, True Encounters in Modern America. When we come back, get into specific stories that she's got, and then into the larger questions of who or what these things really are.